Hello, I'm Dan Yergin, Vice Chairman of IHS Markit, and I want to welcome you to a CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Markit with Fatih Birol, who's the Executive Director of the International Energy Agency. We're very pleased to have Fatih. He has just released the latest and very stark oil market report that the IEA does on a monthly basis, and so we'll begin there. And first, let me say, Fatih, welcome. We're very glad to have you at this conversation.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a great pleasure to see you and to join to this discussion. Thank you very much.
So, Fatih, to start, you did just release the oil market report. Kind of, what are the main headlines?
What we are seeing, Dan, is that compared to last month's oil market report, we see a less pessimistic picture, I should say. Because last month, I said beginning of April, that month could go in the history of the oil industry as the Black April. And after that, we have seen oil prices being negative and lots of pressure on the stocks everywhere, especially on the oil industry, unprecedented pressure.
And so
And
this month is a little better.
this one a little bit better. What we see is that there are some early signs of a gradual rebalancing of the global oil markets. Early signs of a gradual recovery.
What is bringing that rebalancing as you see it? What are the key elements?
In fact, three dimensions there. One, demand, oil demand, still a huge negative territory, but slightly better than a month before, mainly opening up of some of the economies around the world. It is China, some parts of Europe, slowly United States coming. And the road transportation shows signs of life on the demand side. This is one. Second, OPEC Plus agreement. We are starting to see its effects as of 1st of May. This is one. And in addition to that, Saudi, Emirates, and Kuwait said they will make an additional cut. This is the second one. Third, and for me, most importantly, which make us say that we are seeing a gradual recovery, is what is happening in the non-OPEC producing countries, such as United States, Canada, and elsewhere. For example, in the case of United States, we are expecting this year production to decline about 2.8 million barrels per day throughout the year. So putting these three things together, steep decline in the non-OPEC producing countries, such as US, Canada, and others, OPEC Plus pushing their agreement forward, and the demand shows some sign of recovery, brings us to this conclusion.
So we see a similar thing and very much in line with what you're saying in terms of US production decline. I think we're more, I mean, we, i.e., the IEA, and we are more at the upper end of the expectation of the decline in production than other people.
I think we are seeing the shale, especially shale industry, will get a strong hit from
Right.
the current situation. And but as I was telling Dan, many people around the world are saying that we may well see shale is done forever. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. If the prices recover around $40 or above, we may well see shale oil to come back, maybe gradually, but to come back. So in my view, it is far too early to write the obituary of shale oil in the United States.
Yeah, but probably, I mean, the way we see it, at least, it would be the recovery of shale would probably take a It wouldn't be for another year or so before you'd start to see it coming back again.
You need time and you need the right price signals, definitely.
Right. So Fatih, you mentioned China. Of course, China is ahead of other countries in terms of coming back. What do you see? What have you seen so far in terms of Chinese demand recovery?
Chinese demand recovery is, of course, stronger than the other countries, given the size of the Chinese economy, and they have started to open up the economy much earlier. But once again, we see the recovery from two subsectors. One is the road transportation, mainly cars, and the second one, and it is not only for China, for the many countries, petrochemical industry. In fact, Dan, when I look at all the oil-consuming sectors, while we see the aviation, road transportation getting a big hit, the petrochemical oil consumption seems to be much more resilient, mainly because of that sector, petchem sector, produces protective equipments for the health industry.
That's not very well understood, is it?
Unfortunately. I mean, if we are able to, in Paris, we are since 2.5 months in confinement, if we are able to eat vegetables today, it is thanks to the trucks and trucks driver bringing to the shopping centers, to be honest with you. And I think we should understand also the packaging and the plastics play a very important role here. So therefore, petchem is more resilient than the others.
And of course, as you say, the protective equipment for hospitals is...
Exactly, this is very important. And for the disinfection, the material for disinfection, this is also coming from the petrochemical industry. But of course, petrochemical industry also produces automotive inputs. This is going down. Also, for the construction sector, pipelines and the others, plastics going down. But in general, petrochemical sector was the most resilient sector among the oil-consuming sectors.
So, Fatih, you mentioned before, of course, these major cutbacks by OPEC, non-OPEC, OPEC Plus. The G20 was very important in that. That is the group of the major 20 biggest economies in the world. And you played an important role in the G20. Can you explain the role of the G20, how it came about, and why it's been so important?
Yeah. Dan, you are the energy historian. You know the history very well. There are certain junctures in the history that one needs to read the game quickly and in an accurate manner. We knew that the OPEC plus countries were making some efforts to cut the production. But what I thought is that there is a need to go beyond OPEC plus countries, getting the other producers, the very important producers outside of OPEC, such as US, Canada, Brazil. They are very important producers. Also China, UK, they are important producers, to bring them, and also the consumers, because I believe the very, very low prices were not good for the consumers as well. So I thought it would be a good idea to have an extraordinary G20 energy ministerial meeting and call the Prince Abdulaziz, the Saudi of Saudi Arabia, the energy minister who is the chair of G20 this year, and with his support and with the support of all G20 countries, we brought around the virtual table 80% of the global oil consumption and 75% of the global oil production. And all the ministers said how important it was to have a stability in the global oil markets, and how dangerous to have an extreme volatility of the oil prices, both for producers and consumers. And I thought it was a very important political message there in terms of G20. And we have seen after that meeting, many governments push the button. Some of them are the OPEC producers, some of them are the non-OPEC producers, and some of them, and then we should also mention, increase the strategic reserves. They bought oil, such as India, for example. You recently talked with Minister Pradhan of India. He bought a lot of oil when it is cheap, good for the oil security, but also helped the global oil market stabilization. So did China, so did United States. So G20 gave a lot of good input to the stabilization we have today.
So technically, you couldn't get together in person, so this was all done virtually. How did it work? You know, what was it like doing a virtual G20 meeting?
Now, to be honest with you, it worked perfectly. And I have, as you know, Dan, I have attended many G20 ministerial meetings, spoke, and so on. If I'm not wrong, this was the best attended G20 meeting at a ministerial level. Almost all G20 countries and the guest countries were represented at ministerial level. It went very well.
The discussion flowed back and forth.
Yes, exactly. It was a very good meeting.
Right. So it was really OPEC plus OPEC plus plus G20 that kind of brought that part of the stabilization together.
Exactly. So again, this is a gradual and a fragile stabilization process, right. But I see some early signs going to in that direction.
Right. Well, you've been tracking at the IEA how the different sectors of the energy industry and the different markets have responded. Do you want to just give us a sense of, you know, you've talked about oil already, gas, renewables, coal, nuclear,
yes.
Electricity?
Yeah, you are right, Dan. We look at all the fuels and all the technologies, and we said in the 2020, this year, how the energy sector is affected from coronavirus. And in fact, some of them are estimates, but 120 days of this year is data. We have the data for all the countries, how much they consumed, what happened, 120 days. Now, I can tell you that the energy demand, global energy demand, huge decline we expect. To put in a context, the decline we expect 2020 is 7 times larger than the decline after the financial crisis in 2008.
This is all energy.
Yeah, this is all energy, total energy. Global energy demand declines 7 times larger than 2009 after the financial crisis. Coal get a big hit from China, India, United States, Europe. The biggest decline in coal consumption globally after the Second World War. So this is a big decline we are seeing everywhere. In terms of gas, also a very strong decline around the world because of the, especially industry sector being more or less paralyzed around the world. And the, in terms of electricity generation, the contribution of gas is much less because electricity demand also went down significantly. In terms of electricity, big decline around the world. Again, 7 times bigger decline compared to 2009. And I should tell you as a footnote here, I think we all understood how indispensable electricity is for our lives in those days, in this confinement days, for our communication, for the health sector and others. The two final points, in terms of renewables was the only energy sector we have seen slight increase in the 2020. For the following reason, many governments give priority to renewables in terms of electricity grid connection. There are some priority preferred contribution there, and renewables was slightly higher. Of course, it is also that the operation cost of renewables is very cheap. It is also very helpful. Both of these aspects make the renewables more resilient than the others.
Right.
In terms of emissions, a huge decline in global emissions. We have never seen in the history emissions going down so substantially. To put in a context, the decline this year in 2020 in emissions erased the increase in the global emissions in the last 10 years, in one decade, only this year's decline. And the biggest decline in emissions came from United States. It was the same in 2019, biggest decline in a normal year. We saw US being the country where we have seen the largest decline in emissions. 2020, again, largest decline in emissions coming from United States. Of course, as I was telling the others in the last few weeks, this decline in emissions, in my view, is not something to be happy about, because it is not happening because of the right energy policies. It is happening because of the premature deaths. Thousands of people are dying, and the economic trauma. And we cannot be happy because of this emission decline. And if we don't take the right measures, we may well see a significant rebound of emissions with the economic recovery in the next years to come. So in a nutshell, COVID-19 had a major effect on the global energy markets.
So you've talked about gas in general and industrial activity. What about LNG specifically?
LNG is also getting a big hit, of course, around the world. And what I am also worried is that if the demand picks up in the next years to come, which can well be the case, we may well see that the losing appetite for LNG investments may cause some difficulties for the LNG markets, because we also are analyzing the investments for all the sectors around the world, for LNG, for oil, renewables, electricity, and so on. And we are going to announce the results on 27th of May, and the LNG investments are getting a big, big hit as well.
So on the 27th of May will be LNG or all energy?
All investments, the all energy sector, oil, gas, right. Renewables, electricity, nuclear power, all of them.
Right. So as you say, people are generalizing from the emissions, it's forgetting why the emissions have gone down so much. I'm puzzled. We're hearing people say, well, look at oil demand's going down. This means the end of oil. What's your reaction?
I don't think that is the end of oil yet. We still need oil years to come. And we will see how the oil demand will rebound, how much will the rebound will be with the economic recovery whenever it starts. But one thing we have been saying, and if I had the chance to speak at the last CIRA meeting, it would have been one of my main messages. As you know, then it is one of the highlights of the oil industry.
Yes,
at the meeting, and I was hoping once again to attend, and was saying that oil demand growth is slowing down. It is not stopping, but slowing down for many reasons. But we will still need oil for transportation, for petrochemical industry. There will be a transition, but I hope that this transition will be an orderly transition, and that the oil will be still part of our economies, while we see that the share of gas, share of renewables, especially renewables, are growing strongly. We will need oil for years to come.
Before all this happened, you had made the observation that even if every other new car that sold was an EV, an electric vehicle, oil demand would still go up. Looking beyond this crisis to the recovery period, is that still your kind of working hypothesis?
So we have to revisit all the numbers, not only for oil, for everything. But why I said is that for the following reason, Some people think, I mean, there are two confusions in the energy discussions. I'm sure you know better than me. People confuse energy and electricity sometimes.
Yeah.
Clean energy versus clean electricity. There are two different things. And sometimes people confuse the oil consumption from cars to the total oil consumption. Cars today make about 20% of total oil consumption. 80% is coming from trucks, aviation, petrochemical sector, and others. So therefore, the developments in the car industry alone, even it is far beyond the current trends, such as electric cars, wouldn't mean that we would see a sharp decline in the global oil consumption. There may be a decline in the car-related oil consumption, but the oil consumption is much bigger than the car-related oil consumption. Oil is consumed in trucks, in ships, in aviation, and petrochemical industry. In the last 5 years, the biggest driver of global oil demand growth was single out petrochemicals.
Right. So if you, obviously we don't know how long it will take to get to a recovery phase, but assuming we do within 6 months or a year, I mean, what's your current instinct about that perennial, now perennial question about when is peak demand reached? What would you think?
I will leave the giving an exact date to the historians like you, Dan. I hope we will read it in your next book to come. But I will say that to go back to the 100 million barrels per day, what we had before the crisis will take some time. And here, people are mainly focusing on the behavioral changes of the consumers. To be very frank with you, there are some behavioral changes coming from this phase, which will push the oil demand down, but some of them will push the oil demand up. So they may more or less cancel each other out. The biggest question is for me, the economic, macroeconomic picture. And right. I don't see the global economy coming back so strongly and quickly. We don't have, in the previous crisis, we don't have a very strong immune Chinese economy to be the engine of the global economic growth. China, India, they are also affected from this crisis, unlike the previous crisis. So therefore, it will be rather difficult. When I look at the IMF's, for example, expectations for the global economy this year and beyond, I have asked my colleagues not to use the IMF's base case, because in my view, it was far too optimistic. We have used a much more pessimistic case than the IMF's base case, which we used to have our base, our assumption. Therefore, I believe it will be key question for the oil demand will be the macroeconomic recovery.
Well, in that regard, you know, governments have taken on so much debt and continue to take on so much debt. How does economic recovery and green stimulus, when governments will be so short of money, how, what do you think happens there? Or what needs to be the thought process?
Yeah. I think the when I look at the stimulus packages around the world, we talk with some 38 key governments around the world almost on a daily basis. They are preparing, most of them, almost all of them, economic recovery packages once in a generation in scale, trillions of dollars. And what kind of energy policies will be included in those packages will be critical for the energy sector in the next years to come, because a lot of infrastructure projects will be there. And what we are telling the governments is that we hope that this recovery will be a sustainable recovery. And it will include energy policies which will help the jobs creation, which will help to boost the economy, but also a much more modern, cleaner and resilient energy system. But I am scared then is the following. In Europe, in Asia, and I see in North America, there is a growing debate on the people pushing for jobs in the economic recovery and people pushing for the climate change. As if we are having two camps, jobs versus climate. It is very important that we avoid such a confrontation, that we have the right energy policies which helps to create jobs, which is the most important priority today for the people in the street, for the governments, after the health issue, but also to find the right energy policies to put the world in the sustainable energy trajectory.
Thank you for that description of what of trying to get the balance right in this very difficult situation. Let me ask you just a question as a final question about the IEA. The IEA is often described in media as the energy watchdog of the world. I also think of the IEA as the energy conscience of the world because of the perspectives that you bring and the and keeping things in balance. Just what's any big initiatives or focus for research at the IEA over the next several months or over this year?
Yes, Dan, thank you very much. We are working with all the key governments around the world in Asia, Africa, Americas, of course, Europe and others. And we look at all fuels and all technologies, not only focusing one fuel. For us, this year, we are going to provide advice to governments how to build the sustainable recovery packages. This is our most important and, in my view, most urgent task. How we can provide governments the right policy advice so that they put the right energy policies, energy efficiency, renewables, in my view, hydrogen and the others in the stimulus packages, so that on one hand, they see a growth in the economy, but on the other hand, they prepare the energy systems of the tomorrow, modern energy systems. And I was very surprised then that we have a lot of demand from many governments around the world. They seek for advice from China, India, Americas, Europe, Africa, and elsewhere. And this is the number one priority for me and for the agency. And I can tell you that the day after this coronavirus confinement happened, I changed the entire program of work of the IEA. Everything is now around coronavirus and how we can help the governments and citizens around the world.
Right. So you maybe then you just one more question that comes out of what you've said. You did mention hydrogen. And just tell us how you see hydrogen back on the agenda becoming a serious topic in the way that it really hasn't been before.
Hydrogen is coming very strongly for two reasons. One, as I mentioned, people talk about the clean energy, but in fact, they are talking about the clean electricity only. It is solar and wind. But electricity is only 20% of the total final consumption of energy, the world. There is another 80%. So we need other technologies as well, and hydrogen can be a very important option here. What is the problem with hydrogen? There are many problems, but the main problem, it is expensive. The main part of the hydrogen chain is an electrolyzer, as we call it. Very simple equipment, and with right investment, we can have mass manufacturing and bring the cost down, as we have seen in this solar, in wind, or in other technologies. So therefore, I am very surprised, positively surprised, that many governments around the world, United States, Europe, China, India, Japan, of course, they are pushing the hydrogen button as one of the solutions to our environment and energy security challenges.
Well, thank you very much, Fatih Birol. You've helped us this morning to understand the impact of this grave corona crisis in the energy sector, what's happening in the oil markets and the other markets, how they're responding, and also what the agenda is for going forward, coming out of this crisis into recovery, and thinking about what the energy systems of the future will look like. I think that one of the carryaways from this is that that really the IEA is really the foundation for energy thinking and analysis for the world. And Fatih, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a great, great pleasure and a privilege. Thank you very much.